So hello and welcome to episode 34 of the Thrive with Holistic Healing Co podcast. So this is actually part one of a three-part series that is based all on medications for the perinatal period. So I really, as a pharmacist, wanted to break down medications from the inside out. So to really go into depth about this layer or about this aspect or chapter or sort of an arm of treatment in postnatal depression. So the three-part series is essentially to make them into little bite-sized pieces, a bit more manageable to follow, to sort of gather and understand the information that's in there. And I really hope that you do get a lot out of the series. So for the first part in this episode, I'm going to go through my story and my why and really, yeah, share my experience with medication, not just wearing my pharmacist hat, but really from lived experience with my postnatal depression and sharing my ins and outs, my experience with medication. So that's certainly the first aspect. And then I go through some really, in my opinion, mind-blowing statistics around postnatal depression, around the recovery rates and those sorts of things. I'll then go into what treatment is available for postnatal depression and perinatal anxiety and depression, who you should see to obtain treatment, what medications exist for PND and PNDA and how they work. From a very basic standpoint, I don't go really into the pharmacology or the details of how they work, but in terms of just giving you a brief overview of what it is that they can do, what factors are considered really from your health provider when choosing a medication. So it really helps to pinpoint exactly or show you that it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. It really is looking at a whole plethora of factors in order to choose the right medication for you. So I then go into some myths around medications. What should you watch out for or consider when you begin a new medication? And even as a family member or partner or support person, what should you consider if a loved one does begin medication? I go through what are realistic timeframes of medication working. So to really give you a better picture perhaps of how long it can take, how long should you remain on medication for, those sorts of things. I kind of debunk that or nut that out a little bit more. What should you consider in regards to the safe use of medicines? That's a really important one. What do you do if the medication does not work for you? What if you need medication or your partner needs medication? So I go into a little bit more about that. And then I go into, I guess, the whole stigma and the taboo aspects of it. So if you're experiencing that in your personal life, whether it's family or friends, support people, anyone around you, I then kind of go into the route because it's an important consideration. There is a lot of weight or heaviness or extra layers that pertain to medication when it comes to postnatal anxiety, depression, and what people may perceive that meaning or, yeah, all sorts of things. So I do go into that quite in depth in the episode. And so then I go into, well, what can you say to your family or friends if you're on medication? What do you say if you don't really want to share with them that you're on medication? And what do you say to people if you feel like you're experiencing judgment or stigma from people, if you're sensing that from them? What can you say? So they're very practical things that I'll go through. So that's this episode, that's part one. And so just to give you a brief overview of what we'll cover in part two of the series, that will be episode 35, I go into what are the considerations of pregnancy with medications. And although it's a separate topic altogether, I do go into what are the implications of medications for HG or this hyperemesis gravidarum whilst pregnant. So that's the condition where you're vomiting and vomiting and vomiting and vomiting. And essentially that can, of course, affect the well-being and the mental health of a woman experiencing that. And so I just very briefly go into medication if you have HG and how that kind of fits into pregnancy, because I do feel when we're talking about mental health, we can't ignore that that condition can definitely affect the health and well-being of how a pregnant woman feels. And then launch into what are the considerations of breastfeeding with medications, what are possible side effects of each class of medication. I don't go through every single one. That's obviously the role of a consumer medicines information and really going into that in detail when you do, if and when you do begin medication. But just as a general overview, what are possible drug interactions with medications for PNDA? I sort of go into care with natural health supplements, things that may seemingly be innocuous to really keep in mind as well. What are the considerations with alcohol whilst taking antidepressants, medication, and depression or anxiety in general? And then I will also go into what are some possible food interactions, and then what happens when weaning off medication, which would happen upon doctor's advice and consultation only. So that will be in part two. And then in the final part three, which will be episode 36, I will go into a whole other final portion of medication. So I go into what are natural health supplements that are available for anxiety and depression over the counter, and what sort of considerations would you make? Now, I'm not going to be going into clinical studies of how effective certain treatments are. I will sort of briefly make a blanket statement about natural health supplements in general. And then I go into being kind to yourself throughout the whole process. So the importance of being gentle, to have compassion, to have a whole lot of empathy and understanding, whether it's for yourself or to a loved one, to really, you know, foster that at the back of your mind, no matter how frustrated you feel. I think it's very important to always hold that gentleness, that unconditional love, compassion, kindness, empathy, understanding. Then I go through writing a commitment statement to yourself, which is part of the ARMA technique. Now, you might be wondering, what has this got to do with medication? It all comes together. So when we discuss about the treatment and the timeline and the time frame of how long medication may take, if we have a commitment statement to bring our focus back to what it is that we're doing, why we're doing it, it can help to anchor some faith. It can help to anchor your reason why you're going to keep going, why you're going to keep holding on. And it is part of the treatment process, in my opinion. So I go into that. And then, of course, I go into launching into speaking about strategies to use whilst you're waiting for medication to work. So Western treatment is obviously one aspect, but when we look at how else are we holding a woman, how else are we holding her family as a carer or a support person, as someone going through it yourself, what kind of strategies can you put into place? So we go into nutrition, the Ayurvedic principles of nutrition, Ayurveda in terms of massage, the impact of all of the five senses within our body and our system, going into limiting the amount of alcohol, caffeine, the impact or place of movement, sleep hygiene, meditation, mindfulness, self-care. So whatever that may be, you know, think journaling, baths, walks, haircuts, new clothes, just literally sitting and doing nothing, whatever self-care looks like for you. It doesn't have to be very big or grandiose, just nice bite-sized pieces to implement in a day to really bring that grounding. Saying no in terms of boundaries, a lot of grounding strategies, looking at your work-life balance. So seeing, are there any areas of your life that you can trim or that you need to trim that are causing you any level of discomfort? Leaning into your tribe, so finding your tribe and really allowing them to be part of your treatment process in terms of supporting you and looking after you. And the influence or impact of infant massage in the whole treatment of postnatal depression and how you can use that as a real beautiful bonding and connection tool between you and your baby. I then go into what is matrescence and the whole concept or idea of identity shift that happens in motherhood. And I really just give a summary then of medication as a possible piece in the jigsaw of your recovery. So that's really the overview of all of this series that I am intending to go through starting from today. And I really hope you do get so, so much benefit from it because I feel like it is such an important topic. It is such a pivotal part of the treatment of postnatal depression. So when we talk about treatment of postnatal depression, we have psychotherapy, which includes all of which I'll go into that in a bit more detail. We have medication as another arm, and as the third arm, we have ECT or electroconvulsive therapy. So those are the three current. Obviously, things change, they evolve as of recording this episode, but currently, those are the three arms of treatment, of really holding a woman and looking after her in this postpartum pregnancy, perinatal period. And so medication is something that as a pharmacist, I feel I can wear my hat and I can help to really nut it out a little bit and just help to give a little bit more clarity if there's any questions about it. So let's dive right in. So I wanted to really begin with my story. So for those of you that don't know or haven't heard any of the earlier episodes, I've got two beautiful boys. They're now 8 and 4. And after the birth of both of them, actually, on day 5 after delivery, I fell really into the most horrific, painful, arduous, really quite helpless postnatal depression. Now, the first time that it happened with my son, Ari, I assumed it was because of, I thought of so many different factors and variables as to why it happened. I put my logical mind or logical hat on to think, right, it was this. So the second pregnancy, which I waited a long time, you know, sort of 3 and a half years before I embarked upon that again. I was so terrified of it happening again, but I really did my absolute best with my control hat on to change every single variable that I could. There was no variable that was exactly the same. You name it, I changed it. So that's all in detail in my book if you want to go ahead and read that. But yeah, I changed everything and exactly the same. Day 5, I left the planet. Literally, as my milk set in, I literally left the planet. So I went from a connected, joyful, you know, ecstatic mother to literally a blank canvas. Just imagine nothing is there. Nothing. Could not think, could not function, could not do anything at all, make a decision, couldn't get changed, couldn't do the basic of tasks. Everything was a mountain. No heart, there was no emotion, nothing. Just a body, but no soul, no heart. My mind had literally vanished. So that was incredibly, incredibly painful. Now, the good thing was that I spoke up and it was very obvious to my husband, to the family that were around me that there was something not right. And so I was very lucky in that I spoke up. The first time it took longer because we were all in denial, myself especially. And I hoped and prayed that, look, if I just get to sleep, I will get better. And so I got medication to help me sleep as a first, you know, point of call. And unfortunately, it didn't work because the underlying reason for my insomnia was depression, clinical major depression, right? So until my biochemistry restored, there was no way that my insomnia or any of my symptoms could resolve. So the first time it probably was, after the 6-week checkup, I was referred to a clinical team, saw the psychologist, psychiatrist, and I was prescribed medication straight away, really, because I was in a dire position, really, really unwell, to say the least, or to say it really mildly, but I was exceptionally unwell. And so we tried medication. Now, as a pharmacist, I was really frightened and afraid to actually get my script filled from a pharmacy. I was living in Cairns at the time, and that's obviously a very small, not a country town. It's not a country town, but it's a very small city, right? So I knew all of the people around there, and so I was so afraid to get my script filled that the doctor actually had some samples of a medication. And so I opted to use that because she had the samples there. That was the decision that I made, because it just meant that I had one less thing to do. I didn't have that factor or concept of fear around someone seeing me. And so I understand the stigma, taboo, the what will people think? I was that person. So I can appreciate that aspect, absolutely. And so anyhow, that particular medication, despite being on it for a good, I'd say four weeks, it wasn't making any headway with any of my symptoms. And then we changed the medication. And upon starting that medication, so maybe it was about 5 weeks, I lie, but essentially it was in week 11 postpartum. So I had changed the medication. Luckily, there was no washout period, so I was able to just stop that medication and start the new medication straight away. The first 24 hours, I felt a bit nauseous. The next morning, it felt like that, like I had sparked back to life. There was a chemical reaction that completely happened, and I could feel, I woke up and I could actually feel. And I went from normally when the sun would get up and I would hear Ari gurgling in the cot, I'd put the covers back over my head, like, oh God, how is this another day? Just someone put me out of my misery. And that day when the medication had worked, literally within, 24, like the next morning of it working, I came back, and when he cried and was good, well, he wasn't crying, he was gurgling in the cot, I was like, oh my God, that's our baby. And I cried and got him and grabbed him and cuddled him and smelt him, really for the first time properly with heart and joy since day four postpartum. So all that time, those entire 11 weeks or 10 and a half weeks were utter disconnection and pain and darkness. And I felt like I was in a zipped up body bag. So I had recovered, I'd sparked back to life, and then that was it. I absolutely enjoyed motherhood. I enjoyed absolutely every day with him. And I was only on medication for 6 months. And then upon doctor's consult, I was weaned off and I was fine. There was absolutely no difference between being on medication and not being on medication once it had corrected the imbalance that was there. And so I weaned off very beautifully, effortlessly, easily. And then, so much time had passed, life went on, was beautiful and great, fell pregnant again, changed every variable, and the exact same thing happened. Now, this time I started medication as soon as my symptoms set in, day five. So I was on medication from day six, and I started the medication that was effective the last time. So here I was optimistic, right? I've got this, I've spoken up ridiculously early. I'm using the medication that I used in the first instance. But unfortunately, the second time it hit me, I'll say 100 times harder. I fell worse than I ever thought was possible. I really, truly am so grateful to be here, because I had the most severe suicidal ideations. I genuinely wanted to leave the planet. And to be very forthcoming, I really did try for that to not happen. So it was very, very bad. And, all my family my husband were really just watching me like a hawk because it was very, very scary. And the reality of the day-to-day life was one day would feel like months and months at it, like on end. It was the most painful, torturous thing I've ever been through. And so I was frustrated. Everyone was frustrated. You know, we did all the right things. I started the medication that healed me the first time. Why isn't it working? You know, week after week after week would go by. And eventually then, yeah, we had to change medication whilst we tried lots of different things in between as well. But the biochemistry just was not being corrected. And then again, in that week 10 period, we changed medication. So this time I actually had to slowly wean off my other medication. So there was a washout period. So I had to slowly come down, follow a protocol. And then week 11, I started the new medication. And again, that next morning after starting it, literally, so I took it that next morning, I literally buzzed back to life. That's the only way I can explain it. I was back. And the contrast between my mental health and it not being there was, I mean, chalk and cheese. It was so obvious to me that I had returned. It was like, oh, you know, it's almost just that spark comes back. I could think, I could breathe, I could feel. And the feeling aspect for me is really the biggest identifier. And also the thinking aspect, because I couldn't make any decisions. I could not think. And so when I spark back to life, so week 11, so it's the exact same time period for both. That's obviously the way my body responds to hormonal changes that happen from pregnancy to breastfeeding. That surge in hormone or the fall in hormone causes an absolute crash in my biochemistry that sets off this whole roller coaster. And it's only when that biochemistry is restored, almost like my body has resolved from all of the hormonal up, down, breastfeeding, not breastfeeding, what's going on, that I was able to recover. Now, for me, medication saved my life, not once, but twice. And it's ironic that I am a pharmacist because I would counsel and help and inform so many women, so many patients about the use of medication. And it saved me. And honestly, I wouldn't be here without it. And so I'm very passionate that if it's a piece of the puzzle that your prescriber is recommending, that your healthcare team is recommending, then it is. It's an option that you can consider. And I can appreciate the depth and the layer and the questions and the uncertainties. And I go through that in all of this three-part series because I understand. I was there. I had these questions myself. I was uncertain myself. And the biggest take-home message, if you take home nothing else, is that it's through information that we can answer all of our questions. That's the only way. So it's through health literacy, it's enhancing this health literacy for yourself, for your partner, anyone close to you, to really understand the ins and outs of the medication that you're on, that you're going to be looked after and understand the process so much better. It will be more safe. It will be hopefully a more beautiful, seamless process for you by having an open dialogue and having that communication, knowing where you can go to receive information and who you should speak to if you're starting a new medication, you know. And I go through questions you should ask. What should you be looking for? What should you be checking? What should you be aware of? Because all of that is vital information. So that's my story. And so that is my why. That's my absolute why. And I appreciate the no one size fits all. My sharing of that medication that healed me the first time, it didn't work the second time. And that's okay. That's part of the process too, and understanding that as a potentiality, understanding that it's complex. There's no one size fits all. What worked before may not work again. What worked for a friend or a family may not work for you. And I really feel like it's understanding that finding the right key for your lock. That's how I keep describing it in my book, because that's what it feels like to me. You have to keep, look, not that key. And yes, it can be frustrating, but like life, sometimes it's not always rainbows and butterflies. Things don't go according to plan or how they should in a theoretical textbook. We're not like that. Our bodies don't operate like that. It's not an exact science as such. So I think that that's also an important thing to consider. Now, the reason again why I'm so passionate is because of these statistics, and I'm just going to belt them out because I just find them incredibly fascinating. And if you're in a situation or a position as a patient, as a family member, hearing these, I hope it gives you some clarity and some respite and some solace that you're not alone, and that part of the bigger picture of this condition is that it can affect anyone. It does not discriminate, and it can affect anyone of any age, of any caliber, of any ethnic background, any education status, any financial status. It does not discriminate. And so I hope it gives you solace. And for me, it pushes my why, because wow, it's just mind-blowing to me. So 1 in 5 women have PNDA. So that means anxiety or depression. That includes also the pregnancy period. 1 in 7 women have postnatal depression. 1 in 10 men have postnatal depression. Now, all of this equates to around 100,000 families each year in Australia, and that's not even considering the impact of the pandemic. 75% of affected women don't seek help until they reach crisis point. Now, having reached crisis point where I tried to take my life, I can appreciate, but that's not a good place to be. That is a space of absolute desperation, of pleading to whoever it is that can listen or that can help you. Like, I understand being on your knees and just begging for someone to help me, to get me out of this mess and the darkness that I was in, to give me a chance. Like, but 75% of affected people, women, that aren't seeking help until you reach that point. I mean, I can only imagine the impact and the heaviness that's within the home to get you to that point, or the heaviness that exists at that point of your life. I get it. And I don't wish that upon anyone. And yet 100,000 families each year are going through this. Like, to me, this is just, it's just ridiculously absurd that these sorts of numbers are happening, because I know what that feels like. 20% have suicidal thoughts or acts of self-harm. Suicide is one of the leading causes of maternal death in the first 12 months postpartum, with 1 in 4 calls to PANDA having suicidal thoughts. 50% of mothers are not diagnosed by a healthcare professional, with 63% of PANDA callers not having informed their healthcare provider. So these are very large numbers, really. So these are also indicating to me that the other statistics are probably higher, because those 1 in 5, 1 in 7, 1 in 10, they're the diagnosed statistics. If we're hearing that there's so many that are not diagnosing, that they're not being diagnosed, then those figures would be higher. 1 in 5 were diagnosed with depression for the first time in this perinatal period, like me. Now, I knew about it in theory, but when it happened and I was the one unwell, it was irrelevant. I didn't know what was going on. And so that's 1 in 5 families who would have no idea what's happening to them. They would have no idea what to do. They would feel so helpless. And so that is my why. 50% of men whose partner has PND will develop depression themselves. So that's on the postpartumdepression.org website, and I found that astounding as well. The PwC report in 2019 found that PNDA has an $877 million impact annually, with a $5.2 billion lifetime impact, which is again huge. It was found also in this PwC report that 86% of parents with children under two with PND, postnatal depression, were married, but they face a lower probability of staying married. And to me, I get it, because the pressure and the strain and the horridness within the home, I can only appreciate the impact that it has on relationships. So families will break down if we're not getting it treated. And I think that's a very important take-home message as well. And yet the most beautiful statistic is that 80% of women with PND will go on to have a full recovery. And for me, I personally believe if there's enhanced health literacy, we have more or better, bigger tribes to hold us. If we all can appreciate and take away the stigma and the taboo, and there's greater access as well to resources, that's a very, very important one, especially as the health integrity of all of the health systems, if they strengthen as well, then I believe that all women can heal. And so for me, that is a very promising and hopeful future for the world that we live in. And I would love for my boys, if they ever had children, that the situation is so much better for them as well and for their partners, that they can navigate this space with so much more grace and dignity that I certainly experienced, that my family had to endure. It's for them. It's for the next generation. It's for the current generation that are going through it, because I see you. I see you with lived eye experience. I see you with my pharmacist hat on. I see you with my Ayurvedic background and my infant massage, and all of this is true. I gathered all of these skills, I believe, for this junction and this period of time to be able to be of service now, to help with this condition and to really make a difference. Anyway, that's my why, long story short. And if this is the first time you've joined me, you'll come to realize that I talk a lot. What's always short and sharp is never short and sharp. So anyway, now we're going to dive in literally to, okay, medication. So what treatment is available for postnatal depression and perinatal anxiety and depression? So like I said, there's three main treatments currently. So psychotherapy, that includes cognitive behavioral therapy, IPT, which is interpersonal therapy, behavior therapy, MBCT, which is mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, counseling, and there's so many more options as well, with a psychologist or counselor or psychiatrist. Number two is medications, and number three is ECT or electroconvulsive therapy. So in Australia, ideally, the first step is going to be chatting to your GP or your obstetrician. They can then refer you to the most appropriate healthcare professional in your area, or who they think would be most suitable for you and your unique circumstance. In terms of medication, usually they're not used in isolation or by themselves. Ideally, it's when you combine them with therapy or the psychotherapy that we're going to get more beautiful, holistic results. Now, for me, biochemistry was the missing piece of the puzzle. There was no point in speaking to my psychologist because I was just in tears and I couldn't think and I was literally a mess until my biochemistry restored. There was nothing to do until that was restored. And so when it was, we really only had a couple of sessions after that to kink out any, okay, how are we going to move forward? How are we going to maintain this? But so for me, it was purely the biochemical reaction. However, it really should usually never be in isolation. It's a piece in a whole puzzle. And so getting the psychotherapy in combination with medication is the ideal way. And usually what happens is it's a step-up approach. We start low, and add things or change things, modify things as we go. And it's up to your healthcare team to decide what is best for you based on your symptoms, your history, your health conditions, your presentation. So we're all so incredibly unique. So who should you go to obtain treatment? So as I mentioned before, seeing your GP or obstetrician first is amazing. Why? Because they can prepare a mental health care plan for you. Now, with the pandemic, they could offer you 20 sessions with a psychologist. Now it's come back to the 10, which it was pre-pandemic. And so then they can refer you to whoever they deem necessary. So a counselor, psychologist, psychiatrist, or even to the mother-baby unit. Again, if that happens, if that's what they recommend. I mean, of course, I was scared to entertain that thought, so I appreciate that. But upon speaking with so many women, their experience has been really quite beautiful and wonderful, and they will often say how their stay in a mother-baby unit has saved their life. So that's something where just dropping any preconceived ideas of what treatment should look like is such an important thing to do, because we don't know if something is going to be amazing for us unless we try it. And so just being open to that, or whatever it is that they suggest, just being open and trust your healthcare team is the best way to do it. Now, the other thing, part of the GP process, is to really look at doing a differential diagnosis. Well, let's ideally rule out anything else that it could be, or anything else that might be adding to any mood-related disorders. So looking at full bloods, any kind of scans or things, tests that they want to do, you know, if there is an underlying thyroid condition or an endocrine condition or iron levels, or there's something underlying that may be precipitating or aggravating, then that can also show up. And it's important, I feel anyway, to do that now so that we can look after you as a whole. And then, of course, when you go see your referred health professional, whatever they advise, that you certainly follow through or continue their treatment based on the advice that they give you. So what medications exist for postnatal depression, PNDA, and how do they work? So each class of medication can treat specific symptoms. Now, they all work in different ways. So there can be prescription medication that can treat insomnia. Now, there are various classes of medication that can treat insomnia. Now, insomnia is also a symptom of depression. And sometimes you might use medication to treat insomnia, but the underlying reason is biochemistry. So that may not work as such, if that makes sense. So it's just really important to jot down all of your symptoms and being really aware of, well, what exactly is happening. The next class of medication is to treat depression, so antidepressants. Now, there's so many classes. Now, they're not all used in pregnancy and postpartum, but in terms of the classes of medication, we have SSRIs, which are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SNRIs, which are serotonin and noradrenaline reuptake inhibitors. We've got tricyclic antidepressants, MAOIs, so monoamine oxidase inhibitors, and then selective MAOIs. There's tetracyclic antidepressants. So there's a whole different range that work in all different types of pharmacologically advanced manners, and it's not my place to go through and explain how they work, but just keep in mind that there are so many antidepressant classes of medication that, you know, and each class has a whole list of medications, and, you know, newer and newer agents are coming out as we speak, really, with research and development. So the third class is to treat anxiety symptoms. So again, there's various classes of medication. So the antidepressants listed above are often used as first line to treat general anxiety disorders, and also benzodiazepines. Now, depending on where you are, what your physician feels is suitable for you, that's what they're going to make their decision on. And there, of course, are specific symptoms in OCD, PTSD, psychosis, bipolar disorders, and there's a various class of medications that will be used to treat each of those specific ARNs. So all of the medication that I mentioned before, as well as lithium and antipsychotics, can be options a prescriber will have in their tool belt. So what it is very important to do for your doctor, for them to know, okay, this is what's happening, is to be really specific about your symptoms. So what are your symptoms? Every single one of them. You know, you might not think that it's important, but it can just be okay, that now all makes sense. That's up to the doctor to decide what's important or not. So what are your symptoms? When did they begin? So time frame is so, so key. Really the gauge of 2 or more weeks of continual symptoms, that's a real determinant of what's going on. Okay, so when did it start? What makes them worse? What makes your symptoms better? Look at your sleep. So look at the quality of your sleep, your ability to fall asleep, your ability to stay asleep, the quantity of sleep. Are you sleeping, you know, 24 hours a day, or are you sleeping zero like I was? I was sleeping like I could not sleep, but literally like my anxiety, my mind was spinning so much that I couldn't sleep. I would toss and turn and toss and turn and dread when I saw the sun come up and moan when the sun came down. Like I was an absolute mess. But anyway, so looking at sleep, look at your appetite. Are you eating more than usual, less than usual? So appetite is another important symptom to keep in mind. And jot it down on a journal or make a note of your observations. Ask your loved one, your partner or family, what are they noticing? Like I couldn't function at all if I actually couldn't tell you what was happening in that moment or in the thick of it. So it became very important for my loved ones to be able to be my sounding board and my visual to let me know how I was tracking and what was happening with me. You can ask your loved one to come to the appointment with you if that would help. They might be able to give a bit more accurate information to the doctors and piece it all together a bit better. So if you decide or the doctor decides to prescribe medication, so the doctor might prescribe one class of medication or they might start with two different classes of medication. Now, not going into the pharmacology, but let's just say that every class of medication is going to exert a different effect. And that could be on dopamine, serotonin, noradrenaline, GABA, melatonin, and, you know, all sorts of pharmacological pathways. So an SNRI, for example, so a serotonin and noradrenaline reuptake inhibitor, that's going to inhibit the reuptake of those neurotransmitters. So that means that you're going to have more serotonin and noradrenaline circulating to help reduce depression symptoms and to reduce anxiety symptoms. So that alone may get rid of insomnia symptoms. So you may not need to treat the insomnia if you're just on an SNRI. But it's up to your prescriber to make that judgment call as to what it is that you require. So you might require only one, or you might require two initially until the first one starts working and then you wean yourself off the second. So there's no hard or fast rules of what you should be on and when to be on it and how to take it, because it's all very different based on what you need and based on what your doctor will feel is the most appropriate. Okay, and so what factors are considered when choosing a medication? So your doctor is actually going to look at so much more. But as a rough guide, they're going to look at your previous response to medication. So if you've used antidepressants before, they're going to look at, okay, well, what have you used and how has it worked? They're going to look at your other health conditions. So that can impact the safety of the medications that they choose. The adverse effects of the medication. So one that's going to cause a lot of nausea and you're pregnant with nausea is not going to be very helpful, right? Or something that's going to increase the drowsiness and you're already sleeping a lot. That's just a very basic example, but they're going to look at actual side effects and what that might mean for your individual case. They're going to look at the potential for drug interactions if you're on other medication, and also toxicity of that medication in overdose. So we're going to look at the safety profile of that medication and your unique presentation. So someone who has very extreme suicidal tendencies, they're not going to prescribe a medication that has reported more suicidal ideations when on medication, if that makes sense. So they're really looking at you, your symptoms, your case that you're presenting, and they're going to make the best informed decision for you. So one, I would say if your friend has used a medication and your doctor prescribes something different, don't be disheartened or don't think, oh gosh, now mine's not going to work. Different key, different lock, different symptoms, different person, different circumstances. So don't definitely put that aside. The second thing is if a medication that you've used in the past doesn't work the second time, as was the case with me, again, don't be disheartened. Sometimes the second relapse, third, fourth, fifth relapse, it actually can be more challenging to treat. And so it becomes a bit more refractory or a bit more resistant, or it can take a bit more nudging or, you know, a greater chemical reaction to have the same impact or effect within the body. So to definitely keep that in mind. And I guess having this blank slate of no preconceived ideas of what it should look like is actually a beautiful way to live life in general, because if we're fixated on what we think it should be or needs to be, sometimes we miss the beauty of all that it can be. And that's just another case study of having faith, having unconditional faith that it will get better and that you will get through this. I think that that's very, very important. Now, in the Australian Medicine's handbook, approximately half of the adults, now this is not the postnatal cohort or the perinatal cohort, this is the general cohort of population with moderate to severe major depression. So half of those, they respond to antidepressant treatment. Now, I think that's very promising. That's actually a really wonderful, positive thing to know. So most antidepressants are approximately equal in efficacy as each other. However, individual responses will vary significantly. So that means that everyone is going to respond differently, which makes this, you know, not an exact science. And it can be a matter of trial and error to find your right medicine, to have patience, to have faith, keep on going. So keep that in mind. Now, what are some myths around medication? So this is a big one for me, and I've heard it a lot in the community pharmacy when I've worked there in the past. I've heard it from other mothers. And so what are the myths? So the first one is that it's addictive, meaning that if you start an antidepressant that you're going to have to remain on it, or that you only can feel good when you're on it. And to that, I will debunk that, because it's only there to correct any biochemical insufficiency that it needs to correct. It's not something that you need to then thrive with. So for me, once it restored my biochemistry and I did wean off it, I haven't needed it since. So if that makes sense, it's almost resolving that acute situation, and it's been able to maintain itself. It's not something that has recurred. So it's not addictive. The idea that once you start medication, you'll be on it for life. So that is also a myth, because you have the capacity. And generally speaking, treatment guidelines are that you would remain on medication for 4 to 12 months if it's the first time, and longer if it's the second relapse. So for me, the first time I was on it for 6 months, the second time was 12 months because that was my second relapse, and successfully weaned off it with not even a blip on the radar. No changes in symptoms at all. The myth that you will become a zombie or have no heart, you're numb, have no emotions. So that can be the case for some. Absolutely. Certain medications can make you feel not quite yourself. However, so can depression. So for me, it was the contrast where when I had depression, they're zombie. Literally no emotion in my eyes, no heart, couldn't smile, nothing, no joy. Whereas as soon as it came back, oh, I was back and in abundance. So my personal experience was not that. That wasn't the case at all. But certainly certain medication can make you feel just not quite right. And so that is requiring open communication, clear communication, excellent observations and note-taking to say, well, what exactly is happening? Does it, you know, how is it that you're feeling? What's making it worse? What are you noticing? And really bringing that to your health team and trying to find solutions through that. That it can cause weight gain. Now, some medications, yes, that can be a side effect. Some medications can cause weight loss. So that's just the nature of the beast. And also depression in itself. If your appetite is increasing, then your weight can increase. If your appetite reduces, then you can lose a lot of weight. So I ate absolutely nothing, maybe half a sandwich for the whole day for those entire 11 weeks. My husband will tell you that is the thinnest that he's ever seen me. And that's because I didn't eat at all. I had no appetite. I couldn't. Even the thought of food made me want to vomit. And so, you know, yes, I was thin, but I was the definition and the sight of being unwell. And so, yes, you know, looks can be deceiving. Depression can make you gain weight or lose weight, as can medication. You know, you kind of have to make a choice which one makes you feel better, right? That's the crux of it here. You want mental health. You want physical health. You therefore want your life to be joyful and amazing. And so you kind of have to, yeah, that's something that you need to consider. So the loss of libido is one that I've heard a lot. And so, yes, some medications can reduce libido, but also so can depression. Depression can make you feel like you don't want to entertain any of that in your life. So again, it's also the condition and it's also a side effect and not of all medications. So that's something to keep in mind. If that's something that's important to you, if that's something that you definitely don't want, well, then that can be part of the decision-making process for your physician. Another myth, and I guess because I've traveled a lot around Australia for work, I've seen people or patients who really live in a low-tox manner, so one that don't like to use a lot of chemicals or foreign agents into their bodies. And so the concept or idea of medication for them really is a hard one, literally a hard pill to swallow. But for me, my explanation, and I wrote about this in my book too, is that the fear of taking something chemical versus almost taking your life or taking your life or attempting to take your life, to me, I would rather be alive and well than be unkind to myself for taking something foreign, if that makes sense. So I would say I can appreciate that people may not want to take something chemical, but if it saves your life, if it enables you to live and thrive with your mental health and therefore your physical health will benefit too, then for me, it's that benefit risk analysis and ratio. You know, you have to kind of decide or realize that your life and health and being able to think. And I think unless you've reached that crisis point, I'm, it might be harder to make that decision, but for me, it's an absolute non-negotiable. You know, if your mental health is flailing and you're not thriving in how you feel and motherhood, your relationships, everything else is suffering, then to me, it's not a choice. It's a very obvious and clear, right, decision to make. Another myth is that it's a quick fix. So I go through the timings in a little bit more detail, but it's not a quick fix. You know, it can vary with how long it takes for each class of agent to work. So, you know, you do have to exert patience and faith. It's not a quick fix. The myth that it's an easy way out, again, I debunk that because that's absolute rubbish, very much ignorance, because just like if you had preeclampsia or gestational diabetes, you would treat whatever it is that you needed to without judgment. If you hurt your ankle, you would take anti-inflammatories, whatever you need, you would do it. And in this same instance, when there is biochemical imbalance happening as a result of hormones, we need to attend to that. And for me, it is not an easy way out. And I would tell whoever would say that to me with a definite expletive, because I don't buy it. And then the last one is that once you have healed that you won't ever be yourself without medication. And again, I'm a prime example of that not being the case. You can happily, easily wean once things have restored and be perfectly fine without it. So what should you watch out for or consider when you begin a new medication? So for me, it's really important for yourself and your close family unit. So the people that live with you or that check in on you, I think it's really important that everyone knows. Now, there's a question of privacy, confidentiality, and it's up to you as an adult patient to make a decision if you want your family to know. And that's a separate issue altogether of consent and those sorts of things. But in an ideal world, that if your partner knows, they can check in on you and also help you through this process. And so before or when you start a new medication, it's really important that you know, okay, well, what is it? What is it that I'm taking? What names does it go by? Now, that's so you don't double up and you don't think that you're taking two different medications. You need to know the generic name, the drug name, you know, all the different brand names that it comes in, so you know what you're taking. How does it work? I feel is an important one. What are the side effects? So it's important to know what can happen when you start it. You know, it could be drowsiness, dizziness, headache. You could have an exacerbation of your anxiety symptoms in the first few days. And it's important that you know this so that you can manage it. You can plan your day around it. You can know what's happening. Imagine if your anxiety started to flare up and you had no idea, but it was all part of the process. And if you knew it prior to, you'd be less taken aback. You know, there'd be a lot more compassion around it. Now, a very serious one is that some medications can increase suicidal tendencies or ideations. And this one for me is crucial that you're aware of, that some medications can do this. And it's important to spend time with your pharmacist or GP or health professional when you get your medication for the first time to go through this. So it's extra important that your loved ones are extra vigilant about this, because knowing this will absolutely save lives. And having the health literacy about what to watch for, what to do, where to go, if you're noticing medications are doing this, that it can save lives. And that is something I'm very passionate about and believe in, that it is health literacy that can reduce the likelihood of this happening. Right? So just being aware that it can happen. What do you do? Where do I go? What to watch out for? And so if the partner's at work all day and not, you know, maybe not checking in, you know, that it's not completely coming out of nowhere, that they're blindsided by it. But being aware, putting support structures in place, making sure that there's vigilance around that. So that's a very, very important part for me. So when you start new medications, that's an important thing to know. What your medication can react with or interact with. So medicines, food, can you drink alcohol with it? You know, there's some that you absolutely cannot or should not. Even depression or anxiety, you know, that's a separate topic for episode or part three, sorry, of this series. But can you drink alcohol with that medication? And asking anything else that you want to know, okay? It's really important that you start a medication with lots of information given to you. What are realistic timeframes of medication working? So they're not always a quick fix and it can take time to work. The nature of the beast. So we begin with a low dose and slowly increase it if needed over a 2 to 4 week period as tolerated. That's up to your doctor. I'm just saying it as it is. There can be some improvements seen in 1 to 3 weeks. So some improvements within 1 to 3 weeks, most improvement within 4 to 6 weeks, and the full effects may take 6 to 8 weeks, okay? So knowing this is giving you realistic or managed expectations. Now, if after this time period, your doctor will decide, okay, is it working? Is it not working? And then they may decide to increase the dose. They might add another agent. They might wean you off this medication and introduce a new medication altogether based on the appropriate washout periods. Now, a big, big disclaimer right here and now is that it is absolutely vital and crucial that you as a patient or you as a family member don't decide, look, it's not working, and then stop your medication suddenly. That's not your place to do that, right? It is up to your doctor to decide what is the best point of call here. Okay. Now, not only can you get extremely severe side effects, there can be a lot of withdrawal symptoms for some medication. You can have some real brutal, awful, horrible, nasty side effects that happen as a result of stopping medication abruptly. It's a matter of usually coming down very, very slowly, and only if it's based on a whole decision-making process happening. Your doctor needs to monitor you. They need to decide what is best for you. Okay, so it's through clear, open communication with your doctor to say, you know what, this isn't working. What should we do? But being, I don't want to use the word proactive, but being part of that decision-making process and sharing that with your doctor is important. But never stop your medication ever on your own, thinking that either you're better, if you're feeling great, I don't need it anymore, you're going to stop. No. Or if it's not working, I don't need it and stop. No, you cannot do both of those. And that's just not me, because I don't even own a pharmacy. So it's not even as though I want to make money from you filling your script. It isn't. It's about safety. It's about your health and well-being, and that is just something that you should not do and is not recommended under any circumstances. So please don't do that. Now, the question then is, how long do you need to remain on medication? So I mentioned it before that you would use medication until it's repaired or resolved or brought your biochemistry into equilibrium. And then you would remain on that medication for possibly 4 to 12 months, depending on your situation. And for multiple relapses, it can be longer than that. So whatever your doctor feels is necessary for you, it does not mean you will be on it for life. For me, the first time was 6 months, the second time was 12 months, and happily, easily weaned with no issues at all. But again, don't stop. Don't stop on your own. The next one is, what should you consider in regards to the safe use of medicine? So as I've said before, do not stop, do not stop, do not stop. And so on this note, when we're talking about supplies, it's always very important to make sure that you get your script refilled in advance. Okay, I don't want you to run out of stock. And there's, with the pandemic, there's all sorts of out of stock issues happening, that it's really important not to stop, start medication like this. It's just, you're not going to be thriving and getting the maximum benefits out of it by doing that. Now, if a product is out of stock from a pharmacy, then ring around, or you can get your pharmacist to ring around to help source that supply for you. Okay, and then, yep, take it from there. Now, in terms of storage at home, we're thinking there's small children at home. So we want to put medicines up high. They need to be kept out of the sun and in a cool environment, less than 25 degrees Celsius, but really keeping it out of reach. Now, you don't want to drop it on the floor and be distracted and not realize that you've dropped it on the floor and a baby's crawling and then takes it. A dose like that can be toxic to the point of poisoning, right? So it's not for me. I take that very seriously. It's not something to take lightly, to have absolute mindful focus when you're taking medication. You know, just turn the TV off, block out noise if you have to, focus, pop it out, take it, right, okay. And then you can mark it on your calendar if you have to, or set a timer and then, you know, almost delete the timer once you've taken it, because being absent-minded and fogginess is a symptom of depression. I was not functioning. And so, skipping doses or double dosing, it can be really dangerous. And so I really want you to take it seriously, and the safety for your children of keeping it away. Don't keep it in your car. The heat is not good. And also, you don't want anyone getting access to it. Also, if you're traveling, really to take your medicines with you, take enough for your entire trip. I always recommend telling people to keep it in their hand luggage and not in their bags that they check in, because if they don't turn up and they're gone and they're lost, then you're in all sorts of strife, especially if you're overseas and trying to source medication just seems very stressful. So that is something to keep it on hand. So I hope that's very helpful. Now, what if medication doesn't work for you? Now, first, that's probably not what you want to hear. I get that, because you know, everyone wants to feel their best. I get that. But the first thing to do would be to chat with your doctor. Never increase the dose, never decrease the dose, never stop, never do anything to the dosage on your own, right? Unless you're a trained GP, psychiatrist, even then though, you would still collaborate with your physician because that's really just etiquette, professional etiquette. But really, just know that there are so many options out there. And so that key might not be the first one to work. That's okay. There's another key or another key or another key or maybe two keys together that is the right shape. Okay. So yes, I've said it so many times already, to have patience and to have faith. But yes, to know that it may not work for you. I think having realistic expectations about that is really important. But it's also really important, and I will go through strategies in part three, but to do other things in conjunction with taking medication and psychotherapy. And whilst you're waiting for those to work, that at least you're implementing things that are going to have an additive positive effect. So making sure we're eating prana-rich nutrition, you know, mindfulness, meditation, getting fresh air, moving our body. I mean, the whole list is there. But if we're doing that in combination whilst we're waiting for this to work, it will click, it will come together. And imagine having beautiful strategies that you can maintain and have in your tool belt as an ongoing basis. So yes, have faith and do other strategies at the same time while you're waiting for medication to work, okay? You can't put the soul, you know, put all your eggs in one basket and then, you know, I'll just use these as examples, but eat chips and alcohol and not move your body and lie in a dark room with the door shut with silence and just wait for it to work. Unfortunately, it doesn't work like that. You're not going to get the optimum or optimal effect from that. We need to do other things as well. It's almost, you know, diversifying in business, you're spreading your risk, you're kind of something, the penny will drop somewhere along the lines. And the last thing I would say is, well, what exactly isn't working? Specifically, quantitative things that you can tell your GP, look, I'm only sleeping an hour, it's broken. I'm only getting hungry around lunchtime, but the rest of the time I'm not hungry. Like proper, you know, solid responses to say it's not working. I mean, it can be very hard. Imagine for a physician to just hear, oh, it doesn't work. I'm not getting any better. Well, what does that mean exactly? What, unpack it, peel it off a little bit. What does that mean specifically? What does it look like on a day-to-day basis? So keep that in mind. So the question now is, what if you need medication, or what if your partner needs medication? Now, I've done some slides on this on social media as well, in terms of just little dot points, because the first thing that's so important is to be kind to yourself. And I speak of this a lot from an energetic space in terms of Ayurveda and in terms of looking at ourselves in mind, body, spirit, and, you know, the outer soul. And I believe it to the core of my being. If we're berating ourselves about needing medication, we're not going to feel good. We're flooding our body with low vibration thoughts, and we're doing a disservice to the biochemistry and the medication that's trying to repair our biochemistry. So to be kind to yourself, and if it's your partner, be kind to her. Know that there's nothing wrong with you or your partner for needing medication. No, in the same way, there's nothing wrong if you had gestational diabetes or preeclampsia or epilepsy. There's nothing wrong with you. You're not broken. You're not fixing anything. We're just bringing something back into equilibrium. That's it. Like any reaction, every reaction has a, you know, we're just bringing it into balance again. That's it. You're not weak. You are not weak. You're not weak for having postnatal depression. You're not weak for taking medication. You're not. If you had a cut, you would put a Band-Aid on. It doesn't make you brave and bold to keep it open and for it to get infected and then to need antibiotics. Or you know, you could avoid or refuse antibiotics as well, and then that can turn into sepsis. not just your arm being amputated, but it's spreading through your body and going through your entire being and putting you into shock and ultimately death. I mean, really, let's think about it from that perspective. There is no weakness. You are not broken. There is nothing wrong with you. You're not taking the easy way out. You're not. In fact, the opposite. My goodness, I am proud of you for standing up, for going through the process of speaking up, for speaking your truth. I'm proud of you for going to the effort of going to your doctor and following through. You have a solution. You have a possible ticket out of this. I mean, how liberating is that? And to have that prospect of hope is everything, is absolutely everything. So know that I am with you. I am by your side. I support you. I have your back. I do. I absolutely have your back. And I'm so incredibly proud of you. And as a partner, you should be proud of her or him. You should be so proud that they are doing something. They're doing whatever it takes to get better. They want their health, their mental health to thrive. They want their connection back with their children. They want to feel the connection back with their life and their relationships and to live with vitality and fullness. My gosh, that's what they want, and they deserve it. They absolutely deserve it. Your home deserves it. Okay. Now, what can you say if your family or your friends, if they ask if you're on medication? Now, you are entitled to your absolute privacy and confidentiality. You don't need to tell anyone anything at all, right? In the same way, if your partner came in and spoke with the pharmacist and asked, is she on this medication? Really, by law, to show duty of care, we cannot disclose any information about what anyone is on, because everyone's basic human right of privacy and confidentiality is a non-negotiable, right? So if you don't want to say anything to anyone, don't. You don't have to. In fact, I would probably give them the finger and move right along, right? But the disclaimer to that is to really, I personally think it's so important to tell your loved ones, if you are on medication, by loved ones, I mean the ones in your home or the ones checking in on you on a regular basis, because if there is a change in suicidal thought and ideations and self-harm, that it's so important that they're aware of that and they know to be checking in and what, you know, looking out versus having their blinders on and just thinking things are going on as normal. So that for me, I believe it's important to tell, but I appreciate the right to privacy and confidentiality, okay? But some examples of things you can say if you don't want to answer, if someone asks you, oh, are you on medication? You can say, well, that's between me and my healthcare team. Simple. Most people would take that as, okay, yeah, okay, fair enough. I get that. Or you could say, we're exploring our way through the best treatments and I'm really happy with the care that I'm receiving. That's another nice, polite. If you're polite like me, you'd kind of soften it a bit like that. I'm under excellent care with my healthcare team, but thank you so much for checking in. You know, you close it with a nice positive. What are they going to say to that? Oh, yeah, no, of course. Yeah, anytime. Let me know if you need anything. You know, it's just a nice way to shut it down, but in a beautiful, polite way. So try that. You can check the slide or pop, you know, I've popped a little summary, but, you know, you can put it on your fridge or you can carry it in your phone just as reminders as to what to say. And also, if you want to tell them, go for it. You do whatever you do, you do whatever it is that you need to do. Now, what do you say if you're feeling judgment or stigma from others for taking medication? So, you know, you could very well just feel it from their being. You might, you know, intuitively perceive that. And so, if you're feeling that judgment, A, again, like the other one, I would say expletives, you know, finger up. None of their business, right? So it is no one's right. No one has a right to impose their beliefs and feelings onto you and your health. Because at the end of the day, are they there with you when you're on the floor of your bathroom, peeling yourself off to get through the day? Are they there when you're not eating and you're crying and you're absolute in darkness and suffering? Are they there? And if they're not, then they should not even consider a second of mental capacity in your brain. Should not. They don't deserve any of your time. And whatever judgment they have, that's on them and that's not on you. And that's not going to change the reality of what you're going through. Now, the people that are there for you, that care for you, now say it's your spouse, your partner, right? To say that you're feeling stigma and a bit of judgment for taking medication, okay, for loved ones. Because if they're not loved ones, I would stick my finger up and say, carry on, love, move on. But if they're your loved ones, okay, that's a bit more tricky, okay? And so you could possibly say, well, I'm sorry you feel that way. You're acknowledging how it is that they're feeling. You could say, you're entitled to your opinion, but this is my body and my health, and I have the right to choose. That's a very powerful, you know, empowered statement. And at the end of the day, even if it is your loved one, I would hope that you're not getting judgment or stigma or, you know, whatever thoughts other than support and unconditional love from them. That's what I would absolutely hope. But if you are getting that, at the end of the day, it's your body, your life. The alternative to this, if you don't get better, is that it's going to remain the same or it can get far, far worse. And it can get far worse very quickly or it can be a long, slow burn. Okay. It's not something that one day you will miraculously recover. Maybe sometimes, maybe. But 80% of women get better. They recover from this. That's a huge proportion. You're deserving of that. You're so worthy of stepping into your light, the light of who you are when you were born, the light that you were before you entered this, and the brighter light that you're going to walk into upon your recovery. You're so, so deserving of that. And it's no one else's right to put their opinion on you, because unless they've walked a day in your shoes, they don't have a right to an opinion. In my opinion, they don't. And for me, it saved my life twice. And I wouldn't be here without it. I wouldn't be living the beautiful, joyous life with my two boys and living an amazing life without it. I wouldn't. And so I owe my life to medication. And I would happily tell anyone who might look at me differently because of any of my experience that I'm so candid in sharing or shamelessly sharing, I would happily just cut them off or, you know, thank you, but no thanks, that's okay. So in the same way, I don't want you to carry the burden of what other people think and perceive about you, because it's on them, it's not you, and you day to day, you need to be authentic to what is right and true for you. And if you're not thriving and you feel like any of this resonated, then just know that there's hope and there is treatment. It's a recoverable condition. You can get better and you can live a beautiful, healthy, amazing life, and you're so worthy. Anyway, that wraps up part one. This three-part series, I really do hope you got a lot out of it. And I don't know whether you can tell, I had to divvy it up into three parts because I talk a lot. So there's lots more to come. But yeah, I really hope you got some information from that. Share it with anyone that you feel needs to hear the information. And I look forward to bringing part two to life. But until then, keep safe, keep well, and I'll see you in the next episode. Bye.